So, an introduction to a socialist alternative is by no means the easy task at first which it might seem. Because for one thing, socialist alternative stands in a political tradition, a way of analysing and understanding the world that stretches back like a thread running throughout history for over 150 years. So an act of editing which is only paralleled by that which was conducted on the Lord of the Rings movie trilogy. I'm going to try and cut down these next 25 minutes. So, you know, they're obviously not going to be a complete account of the political tradition in which we stand and all the activity that those politics guide us in today, but are rather going to be, you know, a brief account of the core politics of our organisation and some of the organisational conclusions that we draw from those politics, you know, of how to apply them in the here and now. So first and foremost, socialist alternative hold revolutionary anti-capitalist politics. Now this doesn't simply mean, you know, believing that one day we want a revolution to happen and this will be a good thing. Obviously it will. But it's also about rejecting the entire rotten logic of the capitalist system in the here and now. It's about recognising that, you know, the class divisions, the horrific gap between the rich capitalist class and the rest of us is the inevitable result of a system that exists by placing the profits of the few over the needs of the many. A system that sees the world's richest person, Warren Buffett, or Buffet, as I'm sure he probably prefers. So I'm going to call him Buffett, who has a personal wealth of $62 billion in United States currency, whilst half of the world's population live on less than United States $2 a day. It's about recognising that this serious imbalance, this brutal imbalance, is systemic, that it is part and parcel of the way that capitalism is structured, and that this means that no amount of simple tinkering around the edges is ever going to be enough. And it is this underlying assumption that guides us in all the political positions that we take. It means that we recognise the conflicting interests that are held between the oppressed and the oppressors, and it means we resolutely take the side of the oppressed every single time. Now, this is an important point because it can seem to be quite straightforward. It can seem like it's the most basic thing for left-wing people to do. But the reality is that it is often difficult for left-wing people who are not resolutely anti-capitalist to weather the ideological storms that brew around the questions of importance to the capitalist class, questions such as the war on terror. Many left-wing people who in 2003 would adamantly reject the war in Iraq as being a war for oil, corporate profit, all these sort of things, well, actually in 2001, after the September 11 attacks, many felt disoriented and fell in behind the invasion of Afghanistan. You know, on the basis of it being a war to, oppose terrorism, install democracy, liberate women, or any of the other lies that the United States used at the time, which have since been proven categorically false. But on the other hand, because we understood the link between capitalism and war, because we understood how the inherently competitive nature of capitalism leads the world's superpowers to compete with each other over the world's resources, we in Socialist Alternative were able to argue, you know, in our political magazine, on our information stalls, and in our branch meetings, that the war in Afghanistan was an imperialist adventure, all about the power and the dominance of the United States, and it allowed us to actually oppose the war since before the first bomb was dropped. So being revolutionaries is not just about making a diagnosis about revolution and, you know, future social society, but it's also about a clear, consistent understanding about what is the root cause of the brutality that we see in the world today and how best to organise to take a stand against it. So our opposition to the war in Afghanistan is one example of this. Another useful example is the campaign that was in favour of refugee rights. Because initially the Howe government, with the backing of the Australian Labor Party, had mass support for its arbitrary and brutal policies against refugees. Socialist Alternative, along with a number of other groups, joined the Refugee Action Collective and campaigned for refugee rights. And a mixture of, you know, the courageous action that were taken by the refugees against all odds themselves, and a campaign that was started by a determined minority, people such as Socialist Alternative, you know, it actually meant that we managed to turn public opinion around so that by the time of the 2007 federal election, 61% of people actually opposed Howard's policies around refugee rights and all these sort of things. Now, I think there's a couple of points that we can draw from that. You know, firstly, people's ideas do change and actually being active really matters. But it also shows the importance of having a firm, coherent, politically principled base from which to act. And this principle of always standing on the side of the oppressed and the downtrodden has a number of other examples, but I'll leave that to the discussion to be further elaborated. So what flows from all of this is that we do not see capitalism as a system, you know, the system that creates this oppression, as being redeemable. It's not one bit. The fact that every single day 30,000 children die from basic poverty around the world While at the same time, recent estimates from the Nobel laureate and former chief economist of the World Bank, Joseph Stiglitz, calculate the United States has spent $3 trillion killing people in Iraq. You know, this incredible imbalance is not the result of, you know, a few mad individuals like George Bush alone, but is rather the logical conclusions of an insane system. Because since its inception, capitalism has existed solely to create profits for the few, for the ruling class, and all human need has always been subordinated to that project. I think one of the, you know, the clearest examples is the production of food in the world. Based on recent figures, the Institute for Food and Development Policy in the United States has pointed out, the world today produces more food per inhabitant than ever before. Enough is available to provide 4.3 pounds of meat, grains, dairy, fruit, and vegetables to every person every day. And that, of course, is without even mentioning the subsidies paid by the United States, the European Union, big economic powers such as them, to pay to farmers to actually let their field lie fallow. In other words, bribes not to make food. And of course, there's regular cases of food being dumped into the ocean, burnt, things like this. And all of this is because it's corporate profits and not human need that matters under capitalism. Too much food on the market would actually lower its price and hence lower the profits of the capitalist class. So instead, people continue to starve whilst food is dumped, destroyed, whatever. Which is, when it all boils down to it, systematic murder on behalf of the capitalist class in pursuit of their profits. And the same, you know, deadly, but for the capitalist class, highly profitable logic plays out time and time again elsewhere. You know, from the refusal of big Western corporations to allow the creation of generic drugs to deal with the AIDS epidemic, to the business that has actually sprung up in the trading between big business of pollution on the market. You know, it's incredibly insane sort of things. And because all of this is central to the running of capitalism, to see the better world that is now materially possible, it is necessary to get rid of capitalism root and branch. And it is not possible to use the structures and institutions created by the capitalist system to, you know, simply reform it out of existence or any of those sort of things. Because it's not enough to tinker around the edges of a system that is based upon such inequality and exploitation. Because this won't solve any of the fundamental problems, the fundamental causes of the problems that we face. So we in Socialist Alternative stand for a revolution that will get rid of capitalism and lay the basis for a new society that's based upon cooperation and production organised around human need, not the profit margins of a few individuals. So this is why we, you know, don't look to Parliament or to parliamentary parties to change the world for us. Because, you know, a legislation here and there from a body that exists to manage the rule of the capitalists, you know, not to oppose capitalism, can't deliver the better world that we need. Now, that's not to say, of course, that we don't fight for reforms. You know, we do. Socialist Alternative has a proud tradition of this. Whether it be to get troops out of Iraq, to win the right to gay marriage, or to oppose work choices, socialists resolutely oppose all of capitalism's attacks. But the point is that these aren't enough. You know, it's not enough that we're fighting battles again for things that we supposedly won 30 years ago. You know, it's not enough to stop one war when a competitive logic of capitalism demands that there be more. So, you know, putting an end to the war in Vietnam, as inspiring as that victory was, didn't mean an end to all wars. Only getting rid of capitalism itself can do that. So this means we don't look for change to come through the institutions created under capitalism to better manage the rule of the capitalist. And, you know, when you look at it, none of the things that we've actually won that are worth having have come through, you know, an enlightened private member's bill and a conscience vote in Canberra or any of these sort of things. From actually the right to vote itself onwards to the things that we have, which, you know, are worth having, you know, positive change has come from ordinary people making demands for a better world and organising to attain it. So we can't sink all our hopes into the policy statements of, you know, parliamentary beasts such as the Labor Party. You know, we can't expect them to change the world by challenging the interests of the corporations and the powerful who, you know, really run the world system. So for change, we look to a far more fundamental and a far more elemental power than Parliament or any other body of reforms. And for socialists, that power is the power of the working class. The class in society who are forced to sell our ability to work for a wage, but don't actually control the things that we produce. You know, the people who create all of society's wealth, yet don't actually benefit from the wealth that we create. So under this definition, it's easy to see that the working class doesn't make up, you know, simply, you know, construction workers wearing blue overalls or, you know, big beefy blokes eating, you know, pies or working in a cheese factory or any of the other stereotypes that abound. But, you know, it also includes, for instance, teachers, nurses, you know, who've both had industrial action in Victoria recently, I don't know, in other states as well. You know, it includes anybody who has to sell their ability to work for a wage. And this is in direct opposition to the ruling class, the people who parasitically control all of society's wealth, yet don't actually produce any of it themselves. The Buffetts of the world, but also, you know, the James Packers and the Rupert Murdochs. The people on the Business Review Weekly, the sort of magazine for the ruling class, who have put out a rich list every year of the 200 richest people. And in 2007, these people, their combined wealth doubled in the first year of the industrial relations laws off the back of the attacks on the working class to be a total of $218 billion. Yeah, we're not high flyers in here, Australia, I'm afraid. Now, there's a very specific reason why it is that socialists look to the working class. And it's not simply a moral reason that, you know, we think that workers are just naturally better people than the ruling class. They are. We should get that struck too. But it's because capitalism has actually created, huge productive forces that mean that it is now technologically possible to live in a world without scarcity and a world without want. And in a process which, to paraphrase Marx, has created capitalism's own grave diggers, this process has created a class of people pushed together throughout the process of industrialization to collectively produce all of society's wealth. You know, people who keep the wheels of society running. And it is this power, this is the power of the working class that we look to. Because to the ruling class, you know, the most vital thing to them is their profits. Workers as the labouring class, well, we actually have the ability to deprive them of these profits. You know, workers on strike can shut down all of production, which is why the strike has remained such a vital component of working class struggle. And it is through such action as this, you know, of uniting on a collective level against a common enemy, that the ideas that are propagated by the capitalist class, you know, the ideas of sexism, of racism, and all these sort of divisive ideas, have the potential to begin to be broken down. The objective reality that a male white worker has more in common with their indigenous woman colleague than they do with, for instance, a white boss who's attacking both of their rights, you know, this sort of situation could be starkly revealed and can vividly demonstrate what the real divisions in society are, the divisions of class. Now, furthermore, the reason why we argue that this is the working class's power that can change, create a new society, is because we produce all society's wealth on a collective basis, and we actually have no material interest in the continued exploitation and oppression of anyone. But instead, we have an interest in uniting together all the sections of the working class to engage in a common struggle against capitalism. So any struggle of the working class, you know, coming in response to the material realities of capitalism, out of necessity to mobilise this, you know, enormous power, must be done on a collective and a democratic basis. And I think probably one of the best examples of these is the creation of workers' councils, one of the most recurrent events throughout history to have been systematically ignored by all non-radical historians. Now, these forms of democratic organisation have sprung up in every revolutionary situation that's been headed by the working class. Workers' councils where workers organise within their workplaces, where the people who actually do the work begin to be in a situation where they're collectively controlling that labour, you know, within the workplace is actually deciding what the things they do, where the products will go to. We'd actually be able to form links with other such councils on a citywide or a nationwide basis in order to coordinate production and resources to the benefit of all. And it is this democratic force that can create a new society based upon collective ownership of the things that we produce. And it's probably worth noting here as well that it is this vision of the working class running society for themselves, which is the political grounding to actually reject 100% the notion that Stalinist Russia or any of the other dictatorships that use the rhetoric of socialism, such as Vietnam and China, bear any relation to socialism at all. They don't. These brutal dictatorships have no relation to, you know, a view of workers running the world for themselves. So through that, you know, hopefully I've given people a bit of a sense of what it is that Socialist Alternative stands for. Of course, there's much more to go over, and anybody who casts their eyes that way to the enormous bookstore will see we Marxists have something to say on pretty much everything. But these are the real fundamental points, the trunk from which all the branches grow. But of course, Socialist Alternative don't just hold political positions in the abstract. We actually want to play an active role in changing the world. To quote Marx from 1845, the philosophers have merely interpreted the world. The point, however, is to change it. And that is one of the absolute guiding principles for our organisation today. You know, it's the reason why, you know, we are regular participants in all the major campaigns and all the major movements of the day, whenever they happen. Because the reality is, it would be a lot better if there were more socialists who took these politics seriously, who were organising to change the world. And that's why Socialist Alternative, as people have hopefully noticed throughout the course of this conference, are quite open about the fact that we want left-wing people who are interested in engaging in our ideas to join us. And there are other reasons behind that. You know, firstly, it's quite a logical point that the right wing, you know, the other side in society, you know, their forces are already organised. They already have their Liberal Party, the forces of the state, and their polo clubs. You know, they're already set up. So left-wing people who actually want to take a stand against war, racism, all these sort of horrible things that exist under capitalism, well, we need to be organised as well to maximise our influence. But also, if we, in Socialist Alternative, were a much larger socialist party, then we could have a real, concrete effect on the world. We can make a positive difference. And I think one of the best ways to think about it is this, that every campaign, every movement, etc., is a battle of ideas. You know, when the material realities of capitalism mean further attacks, questions are automatically become posed about, you know, why are these attacks happening? What's behind them? How can we stop them? How best can we get other people involved in the process of stopping them? You know, a million and one questions blossom. And for serious resistance, these questions need answering. There needs to be a political leadership that can argue for a road forward. And it's not as if this political leadership doesn't already exist. You know, it does. The problem is that this leadership is not anti-capitalist. It does not hold our politics. Right now, for a number of reasons which I don't have time to go over here, the political leadership of the mass of the working class is the Labour Party and the trade union bureaucracy, who more often than not are they themselves members of the Labour Party. And what is needed is a revolutionary organisation to offer anti-capitalist arguments, to engage in a battle of ideas, and to win people over to our direction forward. One of the best examples is the campaign against Howard's anti-union work choice laws. The union leadership and the Labour Party were undisputed leaders of this campaign, even when the mass of workers who were engaged in the campaign were actually to the left of them. Yep. And this is simply because there was no alternative leadership, and no organisation of our size could fulfil the role of a serious political alternative to Labour. So the Labour Party were the only coherent force arguing for any sort of direction forward for the campaign at all, harmful as it proved to be. You know, they became the leadership by default. So instead of the anti-capitalist direction forward, you know, of mobilising workers on the streets in strike action, you know, of trying to up the ante and hit the bosses where it hurts the most in their profit margins through, you know, using more strikes, even general strikes, these sorts of things. Instead of this road forward, the only viable leadership was one that did not want to challenge the bosses. You know, did not want to frighten them to the point where Howard's laws became a dead letter, because even though they may have existed on the law books, the bosses would be too afraid to use them for the reaction that it would cause. Instead, the tactic of the union bureaucracy was actually to limit the struggle to what the capitalists would see as acceptable, as respectable. To hold a couple of demonstrations every year with the clear message at the end to vote in Labour. And as the slogan of the campaign went, from your rights at work worth fighting for to your rights at work worth voting for. So now we have the situation we do, with Labour, when you cut the rhetoric out of it, pledging to keep at least 90% of Howard's laws, constrained, you know, realistically as they are, to the needs of running the capitalist system in the interest of the bosses. So think of the situation then, if Socialist Alternative at the time of this campaign numbered not, you know, around 200, but 2,000 or 20,000. And this isn't such an incredible situation when you think the Communist Party of Australia, whose politics we don't agree with, but who actually considered themselves to be revolutionaries, they once had a membership around this mark of 20,000. So imagine for a moment that we were able to fulfil the role of such an alternative, you know, active in our workplaces and inside trade unions, as well as on campus. You know, we can make the arguments at the delegates' meetings, at the union branch meetings, and even on the demonstrations themselves, and have some sort of organisational apparatus to, you know, actually be able to hold the union bureaucrats accountable to the mood of the union members. We could have raised credible demands and slogans to appeal to the more militant mood that existed at the onset of the campaign. Slogans, I thought this one up myself, and it's not very creative, but I still think it's true. Slogans such as "Don't wait for Labour," "General strikes can defeat Howard." You know, these sort of things would not be simple propagandistic slogans, but actually the heading of an argument made by people within their workplaces, the unions, etc., with an organisational apparatus to support this argument, and the weight and influence to actually carry them out. You know, we could have argued for an intensification of the campaign to increase the rate, time and generality of the strikes. And a large revolutionary party, through doing this, could actually relate to the mass sentiment and mobilise beyond our own ranks people who they themselves are not yet revolutionaries, but agree that more needed to be done to defeat Howard's laws. Such an organisation that was clear in its politics and with the forces to put them into practice could give a real political lead to all the people out there who are angry about the way the world is. Not just about industrial relations, but around a whole number of issues. People who are, you know, feel frustrated at the way the world is, but who feel that there's no alternative. So just imagine if socialists were organised in such a way around the time of the mass movement against the war in Iraq, you know, the million people marching before the war even began, or at the time of the racist intervention under Howard into Indigenous communities in the Northern Territory. Such a political party, a political alternative to the mainstream parties that exist, making anti-capitalist arguments and looking to mobilise ordinary people, could have a serious effect in the world and could actually begin to build momentum against the attacks of the ruling class. Now, there's another reason as well why we need a revolutionary party, and that is to lead a revolutionary movement. Now, part of looking to the working class to change the world for themselves is that we don't believe that a group of revolutionaries, no matter how small or large, can make a revolution. You know, it's only the mass of the working class themselves responding to the crises that capitalism is constantly lurching into that can actually do that. And we saw during the 20th century that actually not a decade went by without a revolutionary movement of some sort. Now, the horrible, crisis-ridden nature of capitalism is constantly forcing people to fight back. And not just in countries with the least economic development, but last century in countries such as Germany, France, and even more recently in countries such as Argentina, which just a few years ago had living standards which are comparable to Europe. But because of the instability and the crisis of capitalism, has since been undergoing a number of years of economic destruction, and in response to that, mass working class revolt. The point then is that all these situations, only one of them have actually followed with the working class succeeding in taking power for itself. And that was in Russia in 1917, where there was an organised party of revolutionaries who were trained for the struggles of the preceding years and who were armed with a set of coherent revolutionary politics and arguments and who could argue for a direction forward for the working class movement. Because like every other campaign and every other movement, a revolutionary movement, you know, generally starts as a spontaneous reaction against the horrors of capitalism, but very quickly a whole range of political questions are asked and need to be answered. And if revolutionaries are not organised, if we haven't spent time, you know, developing the politics, if we don't have a firm political base from which to argue from, then the battle of ideas will continue to be dominated by those such as the Labour Party who have some degree of credibility in the working class and no interest in a revolution succeeding. Because reformists, like the Labour Party, you know, they may argue occasionally for some change, but only ever within the bounds of what is acceptable to the capitalist class. Because at the end of the day, reformists accept the capitalist system, and that requires accepting its priorities. And it is this sort of politics that time and time again has played the role of holding back and destabilising, demobilising political movements, and ultimately leading them to defeat, and revolutionary movements are no exception to this. So to combat this, it's necessary to have a revolutionary party, you know, that has learnt lessons from the past, that has built up, you know, credibility and confidence in the politics, and who can argue for the path necessary to take the struggles of the future forward. But of course, you know, a revolutionary party is not the creature from the Blue Lagoon. You know, it doesn't simply appear from the swirling mist and the rippling waves. You know, it actually has to be built from the grassroots up. You know, as much as we wish it were, comrades, I'm afraid it's not so. It actually needs to be built from the grassroots up by left-wing people who are frustrated at the state of the world. You know, who oppose the endemic poverty, the wars. You know, the fact that the capitalists seem to be literally fiddling while the world is burning, and people who actually think that this all needs to change. And that's the main point that's deriving from this introduction, and it's the lesson to be learned from over 150 years of revolutionary theory and practice. It's if we're ever to move forward to the better world that can be won, it actually has to start now. And that is why Socialist Alternative, you know, do what we do. It's why we hold the regular political meetings, so we can steel ourselves in the revolutionary political tradition, you know, so we can debate and discuss the major political questions of the day. It's why we do our information stall so that we can find more left-wing people who are open to Marxist arguments and who can be convinced of the necessity of revolutionary politics today. Now, we have to be, you know, honest about our own strength. And the truth is that we're not yet a mass revolutionary party. It's obvious. Compared to where we want to be, a position where we could actually lead the struggles of the working class, you know, the gap between then and now is a considerable one. And to pretend that an organisation of our size could lead the struggles of the working class would be, you know, dishonest and counterproductive. But of course, you know, firstly, we have to start somewhere. But secondly, there are vital things that an organisation of our size and our politics can and have done. There are a number of examples, but I think there are two which show the absolute importance and the impact that we can have. So in 2006, Socialist Alternative supported a tour of Mamdouh Habib across Australia. Mamdouh Habib is an Islamic man who was held in a torture camp of Guantanamo Bay for over 3.5 years. Now, the fact that there was an organisation that had the politics to reject the racism of the war on terror and who were willing to stand up for civil rights meant that he was given an opportunity to speak, you know, of his experiences and his struggle to packed out lecture theatres all across the country. it meant that he was given a voice that the politicians and the mainstream media had been hell-bent to prevent him from having. Another example is the time of the racist intervention into the Indigenous communities in the Northern Territory carried out late last year. You know, this blatant land grab, which seriously upped the ante of the genocide of the Indigenous peoples in Australia. Well, Socialist Alternative, at the time of this attack, used our regular information stalls as a chance to collect signatures for the community in Mutijulu, which is just near Uluru, which is one of the earliest communities to be invaded and one of the earliest communities to resist this invasion. And sending them the letter of support, you know, is a really important gesture of solidarity, you know, showing that we understand your struggle and support your cause. We want you to keep fighting and we want you to win. You know, this could be a very important element of giving people a sense that, you know, they can win. So if you think that these sort of things are important and that the world would be a better place with more left-wing people who are organised and trying to make a difference, then I strongly encourage you to use the discussion period as a chance to raise any or, you know, every question about Socialist Alternative, our politics, what we do, all these sort of things, and to make the commitment to continue to engage with our ideas and hopefully to join us in our project to take a stand for today for the better world tomorrow. And I'll leave it there.